This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
The next two talks are going to be about CAN, which stands for chronic allograft nephropathy, a term that I like a lot, although because it's a wastebasket diagnosis, some elitist group within the transplant community don't like it and prefer to use mechanistic diagnosis to differentiate between the various patients that have CAN. And this has been a challenging area to treat, because we haven't understood the etiology of CAN. And now with better tools, we're starting to differentiate that there are specific diagnoses, mechanistic diagnoses within this group. And with understanding the cause and finding a better diagnosis, then we can better structure therapy. And the next two talks are going to deal with that. So the first one about diagnosis and cause, David Butcherhausky will discuss the recent data that give extra understanding on the various pathways that can lead to chronic allograft nephropathy. David?
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be back for another NAPA meeting. I heard when I picked up my check-in packet that this is the largest group that they've had at NAPA. Is that right, Flavio? And at first I thought, after hearing John's comments, that maybe it was because it was the silver anniversary, but I think it's because the seafood buffet is back. That's just my theory. So as Flavio said, this is a little bit of a tag team talk with myself and Allison Weber, and the topic is chronic allograft nephropathy, otherwise known as CAN. This table, it's a little bit busy, but this is a table that shows the Banff 97 diagnostic categories for renal allograft biopsies. The term CAN actually has been around in transplant since about 91, but it made its way into the diagnostic criteria of Banff 97, and you can see up there it's number 5 on the list. And in its initial form, it was called chronic sclerosing allograft nephropathy. And when you look at the definition, it was described as being interstitial fibrosis and tubular atrophy without or with specific changes suggesting chronic rejection. And it was graded on a mild, moderate to severe scale. And I think this is partly where some of the trouble came in that Flavio was mentioning. So this term, CAN, in some circles, and when you read about this in the literature, started to be used interchangeably with chronic rejection. And it really didn't necessarily tell you a whole lot about what the etiology was of that CAN, or that interstitial fibrosis and tubular atrophy, otherwise known as IFTA, which you also often hear us talk about. Just a reminder, Banff grades everything and has a scoring system for everything. So the fibrosis in CAN is scored on a CI0 to CI3 scale, with CI3 being the most severe interstitial fibrosis, with more than 50% of the cortical area involved. And the tubular atrophy is also graded in a similar manner, with CT0 being no atrophy and CT3 being the most severe atrophy, involving greater than 50% of the cortical tubules. So after this was introduced into the Banff criteria, this figure, I think, really demonstrates what the problem was that developed with the term CAN. This is from an article that was published in 2002. And it was looking at an attempt to describe the various pathogenesis of CAN. And you can see that CAN was being related to immunologic features and causes, as well as non-immunologic factors. And on the immunologic side, CAN could develop from episodes of rejection, from chronic humoral injury to the allograft, and also from non-immunologic factors such as poor donor quality, ischemia reperfusion injury with delayed graft function, recipient hypertension, and of course, calcineurin inhibitor toxicity. So all of these could have the diagnosis of CAN, but if I just told you that this patient has CAN, it doesn't really tell you a whole lot about what is the specific etiology. So although I agree with Flavio, it's a useful term, it really lacked specificity and led to a lot of confusion. So in 2005, BAMF updated their grading scheme and actually pulled out the immunologic piece from CAN and created categories for chronic humoral rejection as well as chronic T-cell rejection. They also, when you look at number 5 here, now we're just saying interstitial fibrosis, tubular atrophy, with no specific etiology identified. So they essentially took out the term CAN and really wanted you to call it IFTA. Exactly. We all thought that. And they remind us that the non-immune causes actually have morphology that can be described on biopsy. And if you see those morphologic changes, you should call it that. You shouldn't just call it CAN. You should say it's changes due to chronic hypertension or changes due to calcineurin inhibitor toxicity. So it was an attempt to try to put some specificity into the terminology. Now, having said all that and gone through all this, I'm going to interchange CAN and IFTA throughout the rest of the talk. So don't get too confused, but I'll try to keep it straight as we go through this. The impact of CAN is actually quite dramatic. We all know that about half of our patients will die with a functioning transplant. The other half will actually lose their transplant due to chronic allograft dysfunction. In fact, I just saw recently that the fourth most common cause of end-stage renal disease in the United States is actually a failed transplant. So I think that's actually rather interesting. And the majority of those cases who have chronic dysfunction of the allograft are labeled CAN. CAN is actually quite common. This is a paper. This is data from a paper that was a randomized multicenter trial that looked at the impact of protocol biopsies versus a control biopsy population in terms of allograft outcome. And it had a little over 200 patients. And you can see at month 6, this line here, patients in the biopsy arm, a third of them had CAN already on the biopsy, and another 20% in the control arm. At 2 years, almost half of the patients in the biopsy arm had CAN, and about 40% in the control arm had CAN. So this tells us that CAN occurs early, even if it's mild. And not only does it occur early, new cases of CAN continue to develop. So there is progressive injury to the allograft that develops over time. So as Flavio mentioned, there is a large study group that's trying to look at this in a little more detail to really try to determine what are the causes and features found in these troubled allografts. And I like that term. That's actually what they use in the paper for the DCAF study. So that stands for Long-Term Deterioration of Kidney Allograft Function. It's a multi-center observational study, and they have published several papers so far. We're going to go over 4 of them today. And the study group has 3 core hypotheses. The first is that there are multiple definable entities that lead to graft dysfunction. The second is these entities can be differentiated by means of pathology, clinical data, serologies. And the third, that the progressive late graft dysfunction is due to identifiable, currently operating injurious processes and not actually the consequence of prior or past injury. And the DCAP study is attempting to look at this by using 2 patient cohorts. The first is a prospective cohort. The second is a cross-sectional cohort. And in the cross-sectional cohort, which is where the data, most of the data that's been published so far has come from, they looked at patients who had serum creatinines of less than or equal to 2 between January 1st, 2005 and January 1st, 2006, all of whom underwent a clinically indicated biopsy, and that was defined as a creatinine rise of greater than 25% from baseline and or the development of proteinuria. So far, as you can see, they have 440 patients in the cross-sectional cohort, over 2,400 in the prospective cohort, and the mean time to the index biopsy was 7.5 years in the cross-sectional group, and it was 1 year in the prospective group. And interestingly, what they found, when you look at the biopsies and how they were read by the local pathologist, the most common primary or secondary diagnosis given to the biopsy in the cross-sectional group was CAN. The second most common diagnosis, or primary or secondary diagnosis, given in the cross-sectional group was calcineurin inhibitor toxicity. In the prospective group, not surprisingly, the most common primary secondary diagnosis was acute cellular rejection. And the second most common diagnosis on biopsy report was CAN. So the DCAP authors pulled out patients who had CAN and compared them to patients who did not have CAN on biopsy. And interestingly, the lines overlapped. There was no difference in graft survival post-biopsy, whether you had or had not CAN. So in a second paper that was published in the same journal at the same time as the first, looked at separating these patients into various clusters. And this had a little over 200 patients, I believe. Yes, 264. And separated them out based on six clusters, and it was read by a central pathologist. It's not important to really for us to go into the details of the cluster, but I really want to show the difference between cluster 1 and cluster 6. So cluster 1 is this top line. So this group of patients had the lowest amount of inflammation, the lowest amount of fibrosis and atrophy, and the fewest percentage of patients who had positive donor-specific antibody and had positive C4D staining on the biopsy. And as you can see, they had the best allograft survival after the biopsy. The bottom line, cohort 6, had the most fibrosis and atrophy, they had the most amount of inflammation, and had the largest percentage of patients with C4D positivity and donor-specific antibody positive, and they had the worst outcome. So the next piece of data that came from the DCAP study group was looking at essentially the question of, is all inflammation in a biopsy the same? We already showed that patients who had atrophy, fibrosis, and inflammation of biopsy had a worse outcome, but is there some difference between those patients? So currently, when you read the Banff grading scheme, only areas that are non-atrophic are scored by Banff. So atrophic areas that have inflammation are not part of the Banff scoring criteria. So this study attempted to actually score patients not only based on the Banff criteria for non-atrophic areas, but also to score atrophic areas. And again, just as a reminder, Banff scores everything. So the interstitial inflammation is scored from an I0 to an I3 scale, I3 being the most inflammation with greater than 50% of the parenchyma inflamed. Tubulitis is graded in a similar way from a T0 to T3 scale, with T3 being a foci of greater than 10 cells per the tubular cross-section. The DCAF authors used a similar scoring scheme to grade the percentage of atrophic cortex with inflammatory infiltrates, and they call that IATR. The Banff scoring gets a little tricky with all the initials. And also tubulitis and atrophic tubules, which they called TATR. So what did they find? Well, interestingly, they found that IATR panned out as a significantly strong predictor of graft outcome. So this figure is just looking at the four different IATR grades. The top line is an IATR score of 0. The bottom line is an IATR score of 3. And as you can see, as your IATR score goes up, your allograft survival goes down. They then did multiple models looking at and adjusting for various features. We can just, as an example, look at model 2, where they adjusted for inflammation in non-atrophic cortex and creatinine. And you can see there's up to a 12-fold increased risk of graft loss if you have an IATR score of 3. They then broke down the patients into a few other groups. The group I want to focus on here is the patients with an IATR only score. So patients that only have inflammation in atrophic areas. So that means a score of greater than 0 and an inflammation score in non-atrophic areas that was 0. And you can see across the board in the various models, there was anywhere from a 2- to 5-fold increased risk of graft loss if you had inflammation in atrophic areas of the renal biopsy, but no inflammation in non-atrophic areas. Now you may be thinking, well, maybe in the other group, when we looked at the other models, there were some issues with rejection. I will say that patients that have rejection had also a 90% positive IATR score, and they controlled for that in some of the other models that I didn't show. And rejection or no rejection didn't have an impact on whether IATR was an independent predictor. Lastly, they came up with a regression analysis model, again adjusting for various Banff criteria. And an IATR score of 2 and 3 had a 2.9- to 4.7-fold increased risk of graft loss compared to the reference. An IITR score of 1 did have an increased risk, but the confidence interval crossed 1, so it wasn't significant, but it certainly was close to 1. So it does seem to suggest that even with mild inflammation in atrial vagaries, there is an increased risk of graft loss. THR, or tubulitis in atrial vagaries, was also looked at, and it did not hold to be as strong a predictor. It certainly wasn't as robust, and in some of the models, the p-values aren't significant. But if you look at the various hazard risks, as well as their confidence intervals, they are fairly close to 1, and many of them are significant. So THR, although not universally significant in these models, does seem to also be a risk factor for graft loss. The last study that we're going to talk about from the DCAF papers looked at antibody-mediated injury. So this was a study that pulled out over 100 patients from the cross-sectional cohort, and you can see that about half of them had chronic allograft nephropathy as a primary or secondary diagnosis on their biopsy, and calcineurin inhibitor toxicity was the second most common diagnosis with about a third of the patients. In this study, they broke them out now based on whether there was or was not CNI toxicity. And interestingly, patients with no CNI toxicity actually had worse graft outcome. So as we all know, in the era of CNIs, the idea is to CNI minimize as time goes on because we assume that transplants will have injury from the CNIs and that we can cause more long-term harm than good by keeping patients on higher levels of calcineurin inhibitors. We'll get back to that in a second. So they then looked at, from this data, patients' C4D and DSA status, and they broke them out into four groups. And the top line represents patients who are C4D negative and DSA negative, and the bottom line represents patients who are C4D positive and DSA positive. And as you can see, there's a striking difference between those two groups in terms of graft survival, and it really seems to be driven in many ways by the C4D positivity. There's quite a big jump when you go from negative to positive. And as we all know, C4D is a marker of humoral damage, complement deposition to the allograft. So whereas DSA just tells us that there's antibody present, but it may or may not be fixing complement and actually causing injury to the allograft. So then they did a hazard ratio, as the DCAF authors like to do, and they compared group D, which were the C4D positive, C4D positive, DSA positive, to group A, C4D negative, DSA negative. And you can see there was a 4.5 increased risk of graft failure if you had both C4D and DSA positive. That held true in terms of risk. If you were C4D positive but DSA negative, compared to negative for both, the risk was 2.85. Less robust when you're just looking at DSA positivity, so comparing group B to A. But clearly it shows that being C4D positive and plus minus having DSA is an increased risk for graft failure. And as I mentioned about CNI minimization, there's some theories about this on why this is true, and some have suggested that CNI minimization or any immunosuppression minimization as you go forward in time after transplant can open a window for the development of donor-specific antibodies, which then can certainly open the window to this type of chronic allograft injury that can develop. So I'm going to stop there, and maybe we could do questions at the end. You think that's best? And I'll come back up with Allison. Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.